We have a discussion about cursors here, so it's kind of hard to take them all out. Welcome to Your Music Saved Us, where two friends blast ourselves into the past to relive and recontextualize the alternative Christian music we grew up listening to in the 1990s. My name's Clifton, I'll be your host for this episode. And joining me is a lost soul who often begs to get hit by a bat, Jay. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Clifton. And that, you know, that description, yeah, it's been a rough year. Okay, I'll go with it.
I mean, getting hit by a bat is better than some things.
True.
What are we listening to for this episode?
We're listening to Huntington's 1996 debut album, Sweet 16.
And how did going back to this and listening to it again make you feel?
Well, funny enough, I turned 16 about a month after this album came out, so it made me feel like I was 16 again, driving around in my 1984 GMC Jimmy.
Was 84 one of the year where the Jimmies were still giant?
No, this was one of the little mini ones, like the smaller
version. One of the S10 ones?
Yeah.
Okay. That's too bad.
Jimmy's like a blazer for anyone that doesn't know.
Yes. All right. And where were you able to go to listen to this?
I want to praise the Huntingtons for this, as their music is easy to find. It's on Spotify. Uh-huh. They've got a ton on Bandcamp. It's all over the place, and I'm grateful.
Well, Jay, why don't you tell us a little bit about the band?
Okay, so the Huntingtons formed in early 1993 in Baltimore, Maryland, except initially they were known as Cricket, and at the beginning were made up of Cliff Powell and Mike Holt. Cliff was the older, cool guy who knew how to play guitar and had a thrash band. Cliff sold a tape to Mike at a church camp, and then a couple years later, Cliff ran back into Mike because Mike lived near a girl that Cliff liked. But in those couple of years, Mike had learned to play guitar too at this point, and he had a four-track recorder where Cliff and Mike could track songs. So they quickly formed a band and started recording stuff. And at first they recorded some songs with just a drum machine. And you can hear all this. It's really cool. They've released all their old demos and stuff on their Bandcamp page or Spotify. But later they added Mike Pierce as the drummer, and they called their band Cricket. And Cricket existed from early 93 to late 1995-ish, when they changed their name to Huntingtons. Probably from a combination of there being another band called The Crickets, which I think Buddy Holly and The Crickets, and I think The Crickets were actually still around, even though he wasn't. But also they had a change in the band's sound. I read that they saw a sign for a housing development, thought Huntington sounded cool, and they went with it. And prior to becoming Huntingtons, Cricket had a more, like, kind of indie rock sound. They also had songs that were more specifically Christian, and they featured Cliff as a singer. And Clifton, I'm wondering if you could play Miserable Sometimes off of Cricket's, I guess, album called Beans.
Yeah.
And just let us hear a little bit of that.
Come off a happy guy. Would you be surprised to see me lose touch? Everyone see me cry. I get miserable sometimes.
Yes, very grungy.
Okay, and if you're listening to this, you've never actually heard the Huntingtons, that sounds nothing like them. But that was the song that got them signed to Flying Tart. So
weird.
I know. So at some point, that song got played by Scott Hatch, who now runs Burnt Toast Vinyl, on his radio show at Drexel University. That playlist that he had with the song listed made its way to Nashville, where Alex Parker saw it. He contacted the band for a demo, and then he made Cricket the first band he signed to his new label, Flying Tart Records. So like I said, Huntington's have put up all their old recordings on Spotify Bandcamp, so you can really see their evolution. And by the time, by kind of the end of their time as Cricket, they were mostly playing more upbeat songs, kind of heading more towards that punk direction. But the real change, according to the band, came when Mike showed up to practice with the song Rock and Roll Girl. This is the same song we're going to talk about today. It later made it onto Sweet 16. And according to Cliff, they played the song like 5 times in a row. Cliff added background vocals, and they knew from then on that was their sound. And I think this was like late 95 that they kind of made this change. My understanding is Flying Tark kept postponing when Cricket could record their first album. So when they finally did, and I think it was very early 96, Mike had become the main songwriter and vocalist. Cricket was no more, and they were the Huntingtons.
So I have the Sweet 16 album here in front of me. Which one of these handsome middle-aged men is Huntington's?
None of them. By the way, those dudes look really old, don't they? I was staring at that cover for a little while. And honestly, they're probably like our age, but they look a lot older.
Right. Yes. I was trying not to be too mean to them when I described them. So, one thing that I really wonder about is, you know, it had to be really frustrating to them to have the recording of their album delayed over and over again for almost 2 years. And I wonder, like, if there was a reason Alex did this. And I noticed when I was listening to all the Foundation albums, that Foundation Volume 6, which is the last Foundation album, called Cricket's Brown Cow, notes that it was recorded in April of 1995 by Chris Colbert. And for those of you who are regular listeners, you might remember that Chris is Duralux / Fluffy, and that he is closely associated with Flying Tart. And that the sound of the album, as you mentioned, is a little pop-punky, a little 90s everything mixed in, you know, to the sound. And I kind of wonder, like, did Alex keep them from recording because their sound kept changing? And were they waiting to record Sweet 16, or was Sweet 16 just what was ready when Alex finally said, go record an album?
Yeah, it's a good question. Part of me wonders if they recorded that with Chris Colbert months later, you know, before that album can see the light of day, you know, they've got to do all the other stuff to it. They kind of change their sound and then are like, oh, wait, we sound like this now, you know? And so,
never mind.
Yeah, we want to record something else. I don't know.
Yeah. There's a lot of good history for the Huntingtons in Cliffy Huntington's interview with As the Story Grows. So yeah, I would recommend after you listen to this podcast, maybe you, if you're interested in more Huntingtons, jump over there and listen to that. There's also a episode of As the Story Grows with Mikey Huntington, but it doesn't talk about the band really that much. It's just kind of a sitting around and chat session, honestly. Some of the things I really appreciated from Cliffy talking, you know, he talked about his kind of fascination with being in a band as a young kid, that he, it's kind of like all he ever wanted to do, and that to the point that, like, he would, like, watch people play in bands and, like, just be really impressed just because they were in a band. Not even that the band was good, just, like, he was impressed, like, that they were in a band, you know? And he tells a story one time of joining a band, and he didn't have an amp, and so he went and plugged in, there's usually two inputs on amps, at least historically, one high input and one low input, and he plugged into the second input of someone else's amp, thinking that you'd be able to hear both guitars, and you know, you might, but not really. So he said that didn't work, and he never got called back to the to practice with that band again. You know, just stuff like that. He also talks about you told a little bit the story there of him and that thrash band. He said the first thing he recorded was a Striper song with some friends at youth camp, and that he was literally, like, shaking on stage as they tried to play it. And then they also talk a lot about their influences. So, you know, at the time, what was blowing up, you know, but kind of before pop punk really came on the scene, you know, and the underground of punk was, you know, Screeching Weasels, Queers, Mr. T Experience. That's kind of what influenced them a lot as they kind of formed their sound. He also says, I really appreciated this line of his. He said, I was 26 before my first album came out, and it sounds like a bunch of teenagers. I really love that.
Well, but I think that's one thing about them is they just really never quit. I mean, it sounds like basically from the time Mike and Cliff got together in 93, it was like, we're going to do this band thing. And it took, honestly, it didn't, in some bands, you know, work a lot longer than that, but it took a little while, but they got it figured out. And then, I would definitely think if you asked them today, they'd feel that they've been very successful at it.
Yeah.
They didn't quit. They did a lot. They recorded a ton of stuff even before they were Huntington's.
Ton. Yeah. I mean, it seems like that was the main thing they were doing was just recording.
I mean, it's like 50 or 60 songs probably you can listen to.
Yeah.
Some are different versions of the same song, but still, it's a lot.
Not many, though.
Yeah.
just recorded a ton of stuff. And they even said, Cliff even said in that interview that he really didn't spend, they really didn't spend that much time like trying to play. They just, shows, they just recorded and wrote songs a lot.
Yeah.
So I guess if you do that over and over again, you get pretty good at writing songs. All right, Jay. So when did this album come into your life?
So I first heard Cricket on the Sweet Family Music, a tribute to Stryper compilation put out by Flying Tart. Huh. And if Discogs is correct, I think it came out in January of 96. And I liked their cover of Makes Me Want to Sing, which funny at the time, I'd never even heard the original version of Stryper because it just my age when Stryper was big, I was like 7 or 8, it just wasn't happening. But
then how did you run upon a Flying Tart album?
I think I just liked the way that looked, and it had, I think, Joe Christmas was on it.
Uh-huh.
Jesse from Poor Old Blue. There was a couple that I was like interested in, so I was like, okay. And so, I started paying attention to Flying Tart. They had ads in magazines. Somewhere I saw that Cricket had changed their name to Huntington's. Their album was coming out that summer. So as soon as it came out, I picked it up.
Do you have any fond memories of it?
Nothing specific, but I remember listening to this a lot. I kept it in my car, and I think I made like, I had a tape deck in my car, and I think I must have made like a tape version of the CD. Because I remember that was the thing that was in my car, and I just listened to it over and over and over. And like I said, I turned 16 basically right after this came out, so this was kind of like the perfect car companion album for me.
Yeah, I personally don't remember finding this band. I just remember always having listened to it, kind of. I don't know, just kind of ubiquitously there. I don't know, it's kind of weird.
Well, they put out a ton of stuff, so.
Before going back and listening to this, did you have an idea of what to expect?
Yeah, because I've revisited this a lot, so I knew exactly what to expect. There's no surprises here for me.
Well, let's talk about this album. The first song, I really don't like it.
In thinking back about this album more and doing this show today, it occurred to me this song kind of had to go first. I'll be honest, it's not my favorite song on here. I think there's catchier ones, but it just starts off with a bang. It's kind of just straight into the song. Like it's a snare drum hit and then boom. And the vocals start with the rest of the band. And it's just like, I really don't like it. I mean, it's just, it's very simple, very short song. Song is basically about not liking what someone is saying to him. I mean, this is, it's short, it's simple, it's fast. But that fits the tone of what this is going to be.
One of the things that really jumps out at me with this first song is, it's something that the Ramones would develop later in their career. Not on their first few albums, but they would have a lot of this, like, and what the Huntingtons do here with that, I really don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Use a lot of these, like, filler words that don't even feel like filler words. They even feel like they really add to the presence of the song. But we're going to hear a lot of O's and similar guttural type noises throughout this album.
But the Huntingtons are the type of band that can construct a catchy chorus half the time just using stuff like, like all those kind of things, it still can make something really melodic out of it,
This song, speaking of that, this song, like several but not anywhere near most of the songs in this album, actually starts off with the chorus,
right?
As you said, straight into I really don't like it. Something else I want to mention here is the first Ramones album was described by somebody as something like a recording of hard-hitting rhythm tracks. And I find that really interesting because, you know, we don't get much, like, lead guitar and, like, solos on this album. So what we get a lot of is these kind of, like, instrumentations that are super rhythmic that kind of set the song apart. There's a bridge on this song. Let me play it for you here. So we have this kind of like, you know, instead of coming out with a lead part or a solo or something like that, we just have this kind of really rhythmic instrumentation that kind of creates the hook of the song musically. Other than that, kind of the vocals are the lead melody in all these songs.
A lot of these songs you're going to see bridges like that. They're just kind of rhythmic back and forth like that. I will say that most of these songs are like 2 minutes long, some under 2 minutes. There are 19 songs on here. 18 of them are original. There's one cover of Be My Baby, which you're not really going to talk about. So Clifton and I are not doing every song on here, although I kind of wanted to because I almost like them all. But
we talked about it.
We're trying to cut the link. Our last episode was pretty long. We need to kind of maybe not make them so long. So we're probably going to go through these fairly fast, but they don't sound drastically different from each other, which is, if you love the band, like I think both of us do, then not a problem. But, you know, there's probably not going to be a lot of in-between. You're either going to enjoy the Huntingtons or not, because they just have that sound.
So digging into the lyrics here, Jay, do you, you know, as we talked about the chorus, you know, oh, I really don't like it. Oh, I really don't like it. What you're doing to me, what you're saying to me. Do you think this is like an allegory for like rebuking Satan? Like, is this kind of like a get behind me Satan type thing?
No.
Well, then what is it?
I think just somebody said something and he didn't like it. So,
just
that. Yeah.
Okay. That's nice. Well, let's move on to the next song. Song, track two, Moms in Rehab.
This one has a little bit of an intro, at least compared to I Really Don't Like It. One thing they do on this one that's a little different from some songs, and it kind of has like a seesaw type of verses, like the vocals go kind of back and forth, they bounce a little bit back and forth during the verses. And it's got some really nice background vocals leading into the main chorus, which they do pretty well on this album in a lot of places. It's something you don't, it's not the first thing that probably pops in your mind when you think about this album, but then when you kind of dissect the song, you're like, oh yeah, there's some nice background vocals in a lot of these places.
Yeah, something that really stood out to me is you know, I didn't think about it before we really started sitting here and listening to it. And there's a lot of background vocals, there's a lot of gang vocals or dual vocals, you know, and it's just like, it's really more complex than you think it is. Like, if you're just kind of casually listening to it, there's more going on. And it's not still super complicated, but it is catchy and fun and interesting, you know, and there's just, yeah, they keep it interesting with the tools they have.
Right.
And like, as you said, there is a kind of a little intro to this song. It kind of starts off with that kind of like high intensity rhythm thing, but then it actually jumps into a bit of a lead part. Let me play that here. It almost feels like the song like takes a break to have that lead part in there.
Right.
And it's not that Huntingtons aren't incapable of writing lead parts. If you go back and listen to their foundation stuff, there's lead guitar.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
So it's, you know, it's a choice by them to follow the mold of this kind of early punk rock theme, I think. And yeah, they do have that kind of like kind of to the vocals, that, as you said, seesaw thing. I like that quite a bit. 'Cause how much longer can my patience last? This song actually has a lyrical bridge to it, but it is a nice little change in the vocal rhythms there to keep the song fresh.
And the bridge, in case you didn't catch it, is she took an overdose and now she's comatose, and now I think she's going down again. This song also references the Montel Williams show, which I looked up. It ran from 91 through 2008, so, you know, it fits. It makes the song kind of dated now, but it's also kind of funny.
So once again, you know, digging into the lyrics again here, Jay-Z, as you said, she took an overdose and now she's comatose. It's kind of a sad song, you know. Do you think this is like an allegorical expression of like falling short of God's demands from us, kind of just over and over again? Because it's like, it specifically says like mom's in rehab again, you know?
No.
No. Okay.
I think this is kind of what Ramones and a lot of those, like, I guess you call Ramones core type bands do, where they're, for some reason, and I know we've talked about misogyny and things, and now I'm thinking about these songs, I'm like, okay, but like for some reason that genre of punk, they have a lot of songs about, like, for lack of a better way of saying it, girls that are kind of screwed up for some reason. Usually it's true. Females, which is not great now that I'm thinking about it with the, you know, a lot of stuff we've talked about in other episodes, but that's just kind of the genre that they're playing, is they always have songs either about girls that they like and they've got a crush on, or girls that have sometimes strange problems. So, yeah.
It's funny because I always thought of the Ramones as kind of progressive in that way, in that even letting women into their lyrics is, you know, because you know, it could be, you know, why is it Jackie who has an overdose? Why not Jack? You know, so I always felt like they were a little progressive in that way, or at the very least, just like, Jackie having an overdose is more sympathetic than Jack having an overdose, maybe. I don't know.
Okay, right.
I don't know. I never thought of it as misogynistic, though. Is it?
I mean, I didn't at the time either, but then I start thinking about, you know, have we ragged on some of these other albums, and now I'm like, ooh. But I think the thing is, and I feel like I even knew this at the time when I listened to this, is that I knew it was like a joke. Like, I knew Mike really didn't have a mom that was in rehab, you know, like I'm kind of shocked that I didn't think that, because I, God knows, I took a lot of other stuff really seriously. But I think you could just know from the style of music and everything that this is just like, this is the type of stuff they write, you know?
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next song. Track 3, JW, obviously about Jehovah's Witnesses. So let's go.
Okay, it starts off with a punk count off that 1, 2, 3, 4, and this one has such a catchy chorus. I love the background vocals. This was probably my favorite song when I first heard the album, and if like 16-year-old Jay had to pick a single, this would have been it. I'll also tell you, at 2 minutes and 40 seconds, it's the longest song on the album. And, you know, my question, Clifton, because JW, sorry to spoil it, stands, I'm assuming, for Johnny Walker, but not spelled like the whiskey, spelled J-O-N-N-I Walker. So, and it's a mystery to me who this man is, you know. And I've googled, I've searched, it's hard to do it without the whiskey coming up.
Yeah, it is.
Should I kind of want to read a little bit of the lyrics, so maybe listeners can have the mystery. But is there anything else you want to say about the music before we look more at the lyric?
Well, we get more of these kind of filler words. Let me skip to a chorus here.
Johnny Walker.
Johnny Walker, whoa-oh, not just Johnny Walker.
If you can't tell, there's a lot of kind of like a 50s rock and roll throwback in a lot of these songs, too, like that feel, mm-hmm. the whoa-ohs. It just, there's another song we'll talk about later that I think is really strong with that. But let me just, obviously the lyrics on this album, they don't take long, so I'll just read them for you. It says, no, he doesn't like to drink, and he doesn't care what people think when he tells them he loves God. And nobody seems to care that he's lost a lot of hair and that he still lives with his mom. Someday I hope to meet him, talk to him face to face. I'd get him to autograph my Sunshine Junior tapes. And then it's the chorus that you heard, you know, Johnny Walker, oh, he's the coolest kid in town. Everybody wants to be just like him, but nobody knows just how. Johnny Walker, he's the envy of my eye. If I could change my name to start with a J and end with an I. Okay, I'll read you the last part. He's got himself a band. He prefers to stand up front at all the shows. He writes cool songs about his girl and about friends and about his girl and stuff that everybody already knows. Someday I hope to meet him, but I know I'm not worthy. There's nobody cooler except that John from New Jersey, which I'm wondering if he means Bon Jovi in that last part.
No, it's got to be just Johnny Walker.
But he says there's nobody cooler except.
Oh.
I don't know if he means nobody's cooler than Johnny Walker except John Bon Jovi. Or Johnny Walker is the cool. It's not clear.
Is John Bon Jovi from New Jersey?
I'm pretty sure, right?
Okay.
I'm gonna.
I mean, it's a trash state, so sure. Let's move on.
So, yeah, I think so. Yeah, New Jersey. Okay, good.
Okay.
I feel like an idiot. I can tell you one thing. He says, I get him to autograph my Sunshine Junior tapes. Evidently, that's a band Cliff used to be in pre Huntington's, or
really?
Some kind of tape Cliff put out. Because I saw in a post on Facebook he mentions Sunshine Junior tapes at some point. So I think
I looked a long time for Sunshine Junior. I couldn't find anything.
I know, but the Johnny Walker thing, I still don't know. If anybody knows,
yeah,
please let us know, because you know, this one's been puzzling me for over 25 years.
Yeah. I think this one kind of goes back to like what I was talking about earlier with the kind of Cliffy talking about the in the As the Story Grows interviews, talking about just kind of being obsessed and semi jealous of people, you know, just got up on stage and just were in a band and play guitar kind of thing. I think that kind of this kind of hits back to that. And so I have a question for you here, Jay.
Okay.
Who was the coolest kid that you wanted to be just like in high school?
Oh man, Clifton, I wasn't ready for this. I gotta think. Okay, I'm gonna cheat, because this is maybe, I don't think I wanted to be this kid, and I don't know if I thought he was the coolest, but at times I thought he was cool. There was a kid in my Spanish class, I think junior year, somehow found out that I kind of liked punk too, although at the time Christian punk. Mm-hmm. And he's the first person that showed me Screeching Weasel.
Nice.
He had a couple of their albums. He also had beer in his backpack that he forgot that was in there in class. And so I remember thinking, this guy, like, I don't think I wanted to be him because I was too straight laced and everything, but I kind of thought he's kind of cool. Just,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Follow-up question: did you ever want to change your name to end with an I?
No.
Okay, you could do it, because like J, you could probably just say J A I is still pronounced J.
No.
Okay. But if there is anyone who wanted to do that, I came up with a list of names that start with a J and end with an I.
Okay.
All right, so we're gonna go boys' names first here. Giovanni.
Wait, that's with a G.
But you can spell with a J. I looked it up.
All right.
Jeremy, if you know, replace the Y with an I.
Okay.
Jedi, right? Cool.
Has somebody really named their kid Jedi?
I don't know.
I'm sure they have. I'm sorry if you're out there listening and you named your kid that. Okay, it's cool.
Anyway. Jimmy. Once again, if you just replace the Y in them with an I.
Right.
Jeffrey, if you once again replace the Y in them with an I.
That one seems real weird. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it is. All right, some girls' names. Joni, that's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm. That seems pretty normal.
Joy, A lot of people, I looked it up, Joy with an I, J-O-I, is actually a pretty popular name.
Okay.
Judy with an I.
Okay.
Or Jackie with an I, either the French or English spelling. So you can do J-A-C-K-I or J-A-C-Q-U-I.
Right.
And then the Jerry, J-E-R-I, is also another popular girl's name.
There you go.
So if anyone wants to change their name or maybe name a child, a name that starts with a J and with an I, your research is done.
Perfect.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Clifton.
Not a problem. Do we think this is actually a kid? Because it does mention that he's losing his hair and that he still lives with his mom. Like, as a high schooler or a kid, it shouldn't be weird that you live with your mom.
Yeah, I mean, I get the sense he's a little older.
Yeah.
Maybe like 30s.
Yeah, I'm thinking so too.
Starting to lose that hair, still living with mom.
Yeah, I mean, I knew kids in high school who were already losing their hair in high school, but still, I don't think that's what's going on here.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's move on to the next song. Track 4, She's Probably Over Me.
This one kind of continues almost from the last song, like straight in with a drum roll. Song mentions church, so there you go. And there's a guitar solo, sort of, in this song.
There is. It's like it's the closest thing we get to a guitar solo in the entire album. Very Ramones type solo. It's like one note over and over again, and then a little like riff off of that note, and that's it.
I like it. It's catchy.
Yeah.
Chorus, she's probably over me now. She's probably, you know, and I think probably all of us have thought about that at some point. So
this is the first song where I really, really noticed how much like dual vocals there are in this album.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jay, do you think this is kind of like a hidden meaning type thing about how, like, it seems, you know, she's probably over me now, right? Like, do you think it's, like, about, like how other people move on from sin? Like, they can put sin behind them so much faster than it seems like you can, you know? Like, it always seems like a struggle with you, but other people, like, they just do it so much easier and faster. Like, do you think that's what this song's about?
Well, because it does say we went to Sunday school together, and later it talks about we pass notes back and forth in church and laugh about the preacher's hair. No, though, I don't think that's what this is about at all.
I'm not getting, like, a lot of Christian here. I mean, we did mention Sunday school for this song, but...
Passing notes and laughing about the preacher's hair, you know.
Yeah, okay. All right, Jay, do you have a first girl that you kissed that you thought you would be with forever?
Ooh. I don't know. Tell me about you two. I don't know that I thought that far ahead, right? Like, I don't think I thought we'd be... It's not that I didn't think we would. I don't know. I just think I didn't think that far ahead. I think I wanted to be together longer than she did, eventually. but no, I didn't think that far ahead, because I was like, yeah, like, again, I don't know, 16, 15, 16?
Yeah.
Not the time of this album, actually, funny enough, so.
Mine was a little later. Definitely, I don't, like you, I don't think I thought, like, we're going to be together forever, but it never occurred to me that we wouldn't.
Right, exactly. Which is kind of how, like, your brain works anyway at that time. Long-term thinking is just not a thing.
No. Like, today is forever when you're 16 or 17 years
yes.
old. Yes. Yeah, there's not, you don't have enough life behind you to realize that things will change constantly.
Uh-huh.
And Jay, how fast was she over you?
Man, it seemed really quick.
Yeah.
A lot of truth here in the Huntington's, isn't there?
Yeah, my first girlfriend, who you know, would be this person for me, literally, like, went to band camp. And before she left for band camp, she left a note on my car about it. She couldn't wait till she got back. And then, like, when she got back, she like, literally, like, broke up with me the second she got back.
She had met someone else at band camp.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
God. Yep. Damn it. Huh.
Yep. Sorry, Clifton. Super fast. Super fast. You know, and then it was Everly Brothers for a while and stuff like that, you know. Sad song. Anyways, okay. Let's move on here. Song 5, Nikki Loves Her LSD.
This song, and I would love to kind of actually check, like, how fast this is, but it seems slightly slower than some of the other songs on the album. Like, this is a little, I mean, when you hear it, not really, but it's a little bit slower than some of the other ones.
Yeah, you're right. It's not at breakneck, quite at breakneck speed.
Right.
Yeah.
And you already heard about half the song because this one is super short, super simple.
Yes.
Basically, the part you didn't hear was just, she was such a sweet little girl, got lost in a big dark world. They took her heart away. Now there's no price she won't pay because Nikki loves her LSD, and it just repeats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So
this is the song that's been stuck in my head the entire 2 weeks that we've been leading up to this. Just Nikki loves her LSD. Yeah.
There's a lot of earworms on this. That's funny. I've had other ones in my head, but of all the ones, this one. Okay.
Yeah. When we get another one of those interesting melodic breaks here in this song. Let's listen to that. There's even a second guitar there playing a harmony there.
You know, and I didn't notice how similar that was to what they did in I Really Don't Like It till you pointed it out.
Yeah.
But this stuff's just kind of hidden in the songs, and you just, one song flows to the next, and it all sounds good, and there you go.
And they're kind of just fun, joyful little songs.
Mm-hmm. About Nikki loving LSD.
All right, Jay. More hard-hitting questions here.
Okay.
How many times have you done LSD?
Zero.
Lame.
Yeah, like...
Okay, did you ever lose someone to do an LSD?
No! I mean, that's what you got me thinking, like, of all the drugs... And not that I'm really in this world, but I don't know anyone that's ever done LSD.
Yeah. I guess it's easier than Nikki loves her mushrooms, right? So
yeah, I guess it kind of works, right, with the rhythm and stuff of the song.
Yeah. Did you ever do any drugs in high school, Jay?
No. I was a good little boy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're very uncool, so we're going to skip the next song. I did want to mention here, you didn't mention doing Martin's Pretty Girls, but I wanted to stop here and just pause for a second and ask you a little bit about these lyrics. So first off, Jay, do you know how, like, when you're with a pretty girl, things usually turn out wrong because, you know, they know what they want and they know how to get it?
Pretty girl that he ever saw, but everybody knows that when you're with a pretty girl,
I mean, I can have some memories of things like this.
Sure. This is the song that I felt was a little misogynistic, just because it's a little, I don't know. But also, maybe Martin's just a simp. I think that's how they use that word. Jay, you teach junior high kids. Am I using that word correctly?
Dude, I don't know. I don't know that word. My kids do not use that one.
I looked it up on Urban Dictionary to make sure I was using it right, and I think I'm using it right, where a simp is just someone who will do anything for a pretty girl, or it could be turned around, obviously, or any combination of genders. But I think Martin is just a simp. You know, it says, you know, he worked hard all night and day just to have her by his side, but she threw away all the money he made and he lost all his pride. So I think Martin's just a simp, and if he just lives, like, buys into it, I think he'll be fine.
But all, this actually was the course that's been in my head for a few days, but all he wants is a pretty girl, Clifton.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's his problem, is he's a little too focused on looks.
It's true.
And he's maybe, because of that, he's attracted to very maybe shallow girls, and, you know, it's never going to work out.
You're saying we can all learn from Martin here.
I'm thinking so. Martin needs, though, to learn from himself first.
I don't know.
God, we have so many questions for the Huntingtons, right? So many ask.
So Martin either needs to, like, go full bore into being a simp, or he needs to back off of the pretty girl thing and, like, appreciate other things about women.
Yeah, and not that, like, he might end up with somebody very pretty, but I think if that's the main thing he's focused on, it's not going to work.
I can get behind this. All right. Okay. Join us next week for another episode of Montel Williams. All right, let's move on to another song here, track 10, Teenage Queen.
Yeah, so we skipped a few because we can't do them all. This one starts with Mike singing, and then the rest of the band comes in, which is kind of a nice variation. I like how they keep things fresh.
Mm-hmm. She's got a job and they're gonna fight, I don't care. She had a lot of strange colors in her hair, but a job and a handful by me. Oh yeah. All my friends say that she's so mean. Always taking the cause and as they see, but they don't understand her like I do. Not you. In a world of perfect fantasy, they're probably the coolest one for me. Oh yeah.
And I haven't said it before, but one thing I kind of like about a lot of these songs, too, is that they almost tell a story, or at least kind of paint pictures in your head of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is, you know, kind of describing his girlfriend, or the girl he wants to be his girlfriend, and how he's saying, you're the one for me, and kind of just gives a little description, talks about what they do together. It's a nice song. It also has a key change in it, which may be the first time we've heard that here. Yeah, so right towards the end.
I think this is probably one of the most standard pop punk songs on the album. And like, not quite as much like Ramone's core. But weirdly enough, it's also like the messiest song on the album. It's one of the hardest ones to really hear the vocals for. You know, last episode we talked about Dear Ephesus, and they talked about how on their first album that they felt like, you know, it kind of had a thick sound because all the instruments were in the same like frequency range. That's what's going on here in this song too, is there's too many things in like the same frequency range, which is, I think it still sounds good. It's just kind of because of that, it seems like the messiest song on the album. Reading the lyrics, see this so the song's kind of about fighting, right? You know, it says, all my friends say that she's so mean, always aching to cause a nasty scene, but they don't understand her like I do. In a world of perfect fantasy, you're probably the coolest one for me. Would you be my teenage queen if I was your teenage king? And then in the next verse is, I'll follow her wherever she goes. She gets off early to come to all my shows, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes we scream and sometimes we fight, but it's always cool at the end of the night. And I feel real happy because I know she's mine, all mine. So Jay, when I read this, I kind of see kind of a thin veneer here over kind of like the wrestling match between Israel and Yahweh, and kind of how at the end of it, Yahweh was like, you know, I like a fighter. That's why he renamed him Israel.
No, I think this is just about a girl.
It's just about fighting with a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, in the last little bridge part, it says, in a perfect world, in a world of perfect thinking, we're probably doing a lot of stinking. Oh, yeah. So I looked on Urban Dictionary to find that if there was a definition of stinking that I wasn't familiar with.
Oh, dear.
And while there are a lot of definitions for stinking that I wasn't familiar with, none of them seem to apply here.
So What does that mean?
So Jay, why did you pick this song? Did you have a girlfriend that you fought a lot with in high school?
No. I think I just liked the catchy chorus. Okay. You know, I also, this one reminds me a little bit, just lyrically, it's got a throwback, I think, again to the 50s, like that whole teenage queen thing, teenage king sitting up on the throne. Like, that sounds like lyrics out of a 50s song. And I just, again, I kind of like the images I get in my head, like she's got a job at McDonald's, but I don't care. She's got a lot of strange colors in her hair. Like, you can actually imagine these things.
Yeah. They do a very good job setting a scene very quickly.
I think also, if you had the tape version of this, this might lead off side two? I can't remember, but for some reason I remember this song pretty well.
Oh, no. Well, according to this one, this is the last song on side one.
Okay, well, who knows, but I liked this one.
Well, let's go to the first song of side two, which is She's All Right.
This is another song that I feel like could have been a single off this. I think this is probably, aside from Johnny Walker, like, the other maybe best song, just as far as like really catchy. It kind of starts with a count off, then a drum roll and a guitar riff, and it just really catchy. This is definitely one of those that's like, like for half the chorus is just those things, but it's just catchy. Like, it just works for what it is.
It really does. Yeah, a lot of O's. She's all right.
Yeah, and it's great. It's super catchy. Like I said, I think it could have been a single if they put any out from this.
I think what you get with that many O's, though, is that it's fun to sing along to, but it's not fun to sing to yourself.
Right.
Because there's just too many O's, like, to sing to yourself. I don't know.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. As you mentioned, this song started off with kind of a very, very fast kind of... I'm going to go to something similar to how it starts, but it's acting as a bridge here. So let me fast forward to that. So once again, we have our kind of like rhythm bridge here, but something else happens here that kind of goes back once again to the Ramones as far as punk rock. I don't know if it was used before that, but very interestingly, what's happening here is when it So there's only like two chords here, right? And the Ramones face this problem. They had to figure out how to make two or three chords sound cool. So let's listen to it a little. Let's listen to it again here for a second, and just listen to like this like little roll, how it, the each phrase starts off. So you get that like that drum goes da da da, but the guitar also goes na 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 na. What it's doing there is it there's like let's say you're gonna play a G chord. What you'll do is you'll actually start on F sharp one step back and like pull into the G.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get this like that sound. It's used quite a lot on punk rock songs.
I love the kind of snare drum roll, how it like gets louder. I think that's like a, it's like so simple, but it's kind of a cool thing to do right there, right? Like it's just, I don't know. It's just kind of a creative way to use something so simple to edit. And then I also, when you replayed it, I thought about it. This chorus would not be the same without those like background. I'm assuming it's Cliff with the other set of O's in the chorus. Like, that second part, right. If that wasn't there, wouldn't be nearly as good. And I know we're talking a lot about O's, but it's just, it works really well. It's just super catchy.
All right, let's move on to the original Huntington song, track 12, Rock and Roll Girl.
Yeah, the song that made the Huntingtons. It's funny. It's catchy. It's a great song. I love the background vocals again, which is something Cliff talked about. Like, they kind of instantly came to them as they just ran through the song the first few times. It's also kind of another story song. This one actually kind of, it really is kind of a little bit of a story, and it's pretty funny, the story that's told. It's just a good song, and it's one that they still play. At least I saw the Huntingtons in 2018, and I'm pretty sure they played this song that night. Like, I feel like it still gets played quite a bit.
Yeah, I looked up some live videos of them playing, and they still play this song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed on it is kind of in the, you know, the chorus, the "She's my rock and roll girl." And yeah, you don't think about it, but there's the even though Cliffy's vocals are just kind of like screamed in kind of a primal way, there's actually a harmony going on here in that Mikey is walking down, "She's my rock and roll girl," and Cliffy's going up, "She's my rock and roll girl." Anyways, yeah.
No,
the wrong note there, but
it's great. No, and it really works. Can I share a little bit of the story of the song, Clifton?
Yeah.
So, I'm not going to read all the lyrics, but basically, he sees a girl ask if she wants to come to a rock and roll show with him. Not his band, one he's watching in the audience. Mm-hmm. It's so exciting. He's so pumped about it. And then I'll read you the next part. He says, "Things were going great. Couldn't be better. Introduced her to Sydney Leather," who is a band they were listening to that I get the feeling it's kind of like hair metal.
Well, they were a real band.
Right, yeah.
I found their record label.
they were, yeah. So they did exist, again, with the name, I'm guessing that. But anyway, he says, "They started rocking and grooving real loud, and we both got lost in the crowd. I caught up with her after the show, and oh my gosh, what do you know? She was hanging out with the band, and when she walked out, she was holding Daryl's hand." And the first chorus was...
Who's the lead singer of the band?
Yep, there you go. First chorus was, "She's my rock and roll girl," but now the last chorus is, "He stole my rock and roll girl." So again, funny song, catchy song. It's kind of I think they knew that they like struck gold when they had this. I mean, obviously they kind of changed their whole sound around it, but it is a great song.
Yeah. In fact, Sydney Leather is the last song, the last track on this album is Sydney Leather backwards, basically.
Yeah.
Sydney Leather.
Yeah, so Jay, more hard-hitting questions. Did you ever have a girlfriend stolen by a rock and roller?
No. But, like, could you be that mad about it? Because you thought the band was cool, too, and, like, you know what True. I mean? Like, of all the people to steal your girl, like, that... I mean, you thought they were a cool band, that's why you brought her, so...
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. That is fair. That's fair, yeah. In high school, I had once had a guy ask me, kind of one of the cool kids, who I didn't really like all that much, you know, but that's fine, whatever. He asked me to teach him how to play a Blink-182 song, so I did. And I found out later that he used it to impress a girl that I had a crush on and ask her out.
Oh,
that
was, God damn it.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, well.
That's how those things work, isn't it?
Yep. All right. Moving on. Number 14, Veronica.
This one kind of starts with, like, clean guitar strumming, which is a little different. I mean, I know, like, you know, most of these songs are very similar sounding, so we're picking out some of the differences. I want to say this song, and I think the clean is part of this too, this song is very 50s-ish sounding to me, yeah. Like a real throwback, both in the lyrics and the sound on this one. Even the name Veronica, like, to me is a throwback to that. So this one is, I mean, this honestly could have been written by like a band back then, just probably a little bit slow, yeah. More slow, but otherwise, like, you know, it's Veronica, I think I love you, never want to put anybody above you, no, because you're the only one for me. So this one actually does start with the chorus, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, do you remember the night at the dance when I walked up to you and I took your hand? We danced all night and I held you so tight. I mean, come on. That sounds exactly like some kind of 50s doo-wop or, you know, early rock type stuff. This one has another good use of background vocals and just another catchy song.
There's a point right here where he misses a note I want to play because it's great. When he says, I held you so tight, on tight, he really misses the note here. Not even close.
Yeah.
It's great. This one also has another one of these weird, not a solos, but this one isn't just a rhythmic thing, and it's not also not just like a weird Ramones-esque... If this was high school rock era, I think they would use a keyboard for that, all of the Screeching Weasels.
Yeah, I think you're right.
All right, so Jay, when he says, you know, I never want to put anybody above you, is he not talking about Jesus then?
So Veronica is a code word for Jesus?
For Jesus, yeah.
No. I think it's just the girl.
Like, there's not much Christian stuff on this album, Jay.
You're right, Clifton. You were right.
Okay. Well, I guess let's move on. You didn't mention Drexel U, but I do want to mention that let's listen to the very beginning here because I like how it goes. So first off, Drexel U is the university, as you mentioned, where they played their song. The song got played on the college station and they got them discovered. But I like here that they go from like a Beach Boys sounding vocals to a very Ramone sounding vocals in about like under 5 seconds.
Right.
The verse there is it's very Beach Boys. You know, you could probably associate it with just early rock and roll, but it's very Beach Boys. And then they go straight into this very punk rock chorus, yeah.
Yeah, I remember even hearing that back when I first got the album and thinking that sounded like the Beach Boys. Like, that's how on the nose it is.
Yeah.
Right there. Which, like, that works with this style. I mean, the Queers had lots of songs that sound almost exactly like the Beach Boys. Like, that's right. Definitely another band that this kind of genre borrows a lot from.
Yeah, the Queers were another one of those bands that kind of made pop punk through the mid-80s, kind of holding on to that Ramones-esque sound, yeah. All right, track 16, Heavy Metal's Alive in Baltimore.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the song, not because it's the catchiest song. It's not really. In fact, I honestly wish it were a little bit catchier. But I really like the story behind it, and again, it's kind of funny. And I didn't know the story until more recently, but it's based on at least Mike and Cliff, possibly the other Mike, the drummer, going to see the Ramones. The only time they saw the Ramones play live in February of 96 at this place called Hammerjacks in Baltimore. And my understanding was Hammerjacks was like a place where like a lot of kind of metal bands played. And Ramones are not metal, but, you know, same. They were really active in the 80s and stuff like that. And so, anyway, they went to the show, and they're looking around. They're like, oh, my God, heavy metal is alive in Baltimore, because tons of metalheads in the audience.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a funny song. It's not the catchiest, but I just kind of like the images I get as I listen to it.
I don't know if there's a lot of references in the song, but there's, like, they mention Vince Neil, who was the vocalist for Motley Crue. And then the last line of the lyrics is, "Hey ho, let's go get a lobotomy." And of course, "Hey ho" is a very classic Ramones kind of nonsense vocals or lyrics. And it's on their first album or second album. They have a song about, teenage lobotomy.
Yeah, I thought talked about that, yeah. Right.
I don't know if there's more references in the rest of the song that I just didn't pick up on, but there's those two. Also, funny enough, in 1981, with their album Pleasant Dreams, the Ramones kind of took a slight detour into metal sound that they later admitted was something that their label asked them to do in an attempt to sell any albums at all, because people did not buy Ramones albums.
Huh. Interesting.
All right, Jay, you didn't... mark any more songs on the albums that we talked about. Why didn't you mark Secret Agent Johnny Bravo?
You know, actually, I thought about it, I'll be honest, because it's catchy too, and the guitar part's really catchy. I just felt like we couldn't cover them all.
Yeah. It was, at least from my memory, it was my friend Stuart's favorite song on the album, so he really appreciated that song. All right, so overall, Jay, what do you think?
I think it's great. I still love this album. And I'm going to be honest, and I know this is probably not cool with some people, I think it's my favorite Huntington's album, honestly. I know a lot of people disagree. Yeah. Probably even members of the band disagree with this, but it's the one, you know, it's the one I started with, the one I probably listened to the most. I think the songs are really catchy. Probably a criticism is, unlike a lot of their albums after this, where they would kind of vary up, like this, they'd have some of those really like faster kind of, still in that Ramones core thing, but faster edge songs, and they'd speed up and slow down more, and they, like you said, they bring in keyboards, they do all stuff. No, all these songs are almost the same speed, same style, but I just think they're really catchy. Like, it's not easy to write a catchy song like this, and
no,
I'm a fan.
Yeah, I agree, and like I said earlier, you know, it's kind of just a bunch of like joyful fun. Like, you can tell they were having fun doing this, right? There is a sound to a song that you can't bring about if you're not enjoying what you're doing. And that's very clear here that they were enjoying what they're doing. I am puzzled by the fact that there's no Christianity on this album. Jay, what's going on there?
Oh, yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot. Not that we didn't think and talk about this at the time, right? There was that whole debate of, is it Christian band or Christians in a band? Do they have to be singing about God all the time for it to be Christian music?
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know. I mean, allow me, here's my train of thought. a little bit on this just for this specific album, but like, you know, Flying Tart, the label this was on, came out of the Christian market. Alex Parker, from what I understand, worked at REX, which is a kind of a Christian alternative label, formed his own label. So the bands that he got kind of came from this Christian world. Some of those bands, though, didn't write or sing about God at all. The only reason they were Christian is because, basically, of the label and the world they came from. And the label probably wouldn't exist without Christian bookstores. Right?
Right.
Because that's kind of the
distribution
channel
system, yeah.
Yeah, for what it went through. And so, I don't know, when I started thinking about this more, I was like, okay, if Christian bookstores didn't exist, there were no Christian labels, what would happen to this album? Probably this one, honestly, would be put out by a regular label. Like, I think the Huntingtons could have been on Lookout or one of those labels that had that similar sound of punk stuff. Some of the other albums we've covered probably would have gone nowhere because people would have been like, nope. But it seems like the only thing that makes these albums Christian is because they're in Christian bookstores, which then just, the more I started thinking about this, the more I was like, oh my god, this is like even more problematic because like Christian bookstores kind of took off because, you know, people have disposable income and these bookstores gave people a place to belong, and kind of by like buying stuff, that's how you became Christian, right? You know, if I'm purchasing something Christian, I'm like drawn closer to God. I don't know. It's kind of like we have a hybrid, right? So I'm doing my part by saving the planet because I bought a hybrid, which is not true, but like it's the same kind of idea, right? I'm purchasing something, so it actually like means something deeper than that. And I don't know. The more I just started thinking about Christian bookstores and all this, and it's just like, oh my god, it's just capitalism, just cloaked in kind of this righteous thing. And
And let me make this even worse in that. You know, Christian bookstores at first were like a place that's just say, here's where you can buy your Christian stuff, like the stuff that doesn't appeal to other people, right?
Right.
But over time, and especially through the 90s, they became more of an insular culture where the people who were shopping there now had a completely different, like they weren't exposed to the outside world. They could choose to go to a media place and have Christian music and Christian books and Christian magazines and Christian artwork and Christian whatever, and never expose themselves to the outside world.
Yeah.
And so in a way it kind of helped create the world that we live in today, where you have this very insular culture that doesn't recognize the rest of the world.
It's such a good point, yeah, because, yeah, by their prime, which I think was around this time, like the late 90s, like you could get everything there. You're right. Movies, books, you know, music albums. Like, there was no reason for you to interact with anything that wasn't in that realm, and that's a problem.
Specially branded mints.
Yeah.
Do you remember Testaments?
Yeah, exactly, right. Everything. The little t-shirts they'd sell that were just knockoffs of other stuff.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it,
it
was a problem. And I was digging more into this idea of like what really made it, what made this stuff Christian. And I want to read you a quote that this is from a book called Apostles of Rock. The subtitle is A Splintered World of Contemporary Christian Music by J.R. Howard and John M. Streck. And in this, he quotes a guy named, I believe, John Fisher from CCM Magazine. So, Contemporary Christian Music Magazine. So let me just kind of jump to the quote. He says, Fisher suggests in an article in Contemporary Christian Music that it is helpful to think of Christian music in organizational terms, rather than trying to decide, is it Christian because of, sorry, this is me talking, not the quote, rather than trying to decide if it's, you know, Christian because it's Christian singing it, which can be problematic if they're singing stuff you don't like, right? Or if it's, you know, explicitly singing about God. Well, what do you do when it's somebody who you don't view as a Christian is singing about? There's all these things that start to be a problem when you have those definitions. So this is what he says. I'm going back to the quote. Christian music, he argues here, is music that is promoted, distributed, broadcast, and sold primarily by and to Christians. At this point, then, CCM is no longer defined by the thematic content of its lyrics, but by corporate relations and market characteristics. And I thought, wow, well, that probably is the most accurate description of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you learn that, like, some of these Christian record labels like Word and some of the bigger ones were actually owned by the larger secular labels, I don't know. It's just like this whole world that so many of us were caught up in was really just like another market and another way to sell things. Yep. But yet it had a lot of meaning for us. And again, I think even like, the Huntingtons must be Christian because they came from the Christian bookstore and are on this Christian label. And not that they're not, they haven't ever said they're not, but I'm just saying like that was the only way you knew. Is because, well, they say they are, so it's fine, you know? And like,
right.
And I'm thinking back, like, why did I need that? What was wrong with just picking up, like, you know, the Queers, Squirtle and the Riverdales, like one of those other bands that sounded like them from another place. But yet I needed that permission, and I needed it to come in that certain package. Yeah. And I will say the Huntingtons have, and we'll talk about it in a minute, but have kind of stayed together for a while. I mean, they've obviously taken some breaks, but stayed together. And sometimes I wonder if they've managed to do that because they avoided this mess a little bit. I think they probably had to answer lots of questions early on.
Oh, yes.
But I wonder if they were able, you know, as they grew as a band and being able to play more with bands outside of this bubble, if that helped.
How did you think about it at the time, like in high school? How did you think about the Huntingtons?
I think I just, that was the question, right? Like, I think it was just like, oh, they're Christians in a band. They play this style of music. It's cool.
Yeah. I always thought of them as like a, you know, a clean alternative.
Yeah.
To like, you know, so, you know, they don't cuss, they don't talk about drugs. And so it's a non, more than Christian, it's a non-worldly alternative to the secular bands.
You're right. The no cussing thing was really important. Like, oh, it's clean music, right? For some reason that was like super important.
Still important. If you read the, you're on Facebook and you follow the groups like, Old School Tooth and Nail or 90s,
there has been some debate about this. You're right. Recently,
yeah, especially with the new Under Oath album that where they cuss on it, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that I don't know that was such a big issue at the time because I wasn't really thinking about what they're singing about. As long as they didn't say these words, it was okay. I mean, Huntingtons are singing about Nikki loves her LSD, and I mean, I know it's a joke, but all this stuff. But hey. They're not saying shit or fuck or anything, and so it's totally fine. Yeah. This reminds me, there's that quote, and I'm probably not going to say it exactly right, but I'll get the point, by Tony Campolo, that kind of well-known person in the Christian world, but he had a really good quote, and he said something about, and I'm not going to get the number right, but he said something about, you know, there's thousands of people dying of hunger today in Africa, and you don't give a shit. And then he said, and to add to that, more of you are upset by the word I just used than the fact that there are people dying right now. And it's like, ooh, damn. Like, that's true. Like,
yeah.
So true.
Yeah. I remember once when I was in high school, I was like younger high school, probably sophomore. I remember I got mad and I said fuck about something. And I remember afterwards having to come, like, I was just like, I guess I'm just the kind of guy who says fuck, you know, like, and then, of course, I had to, like a couple weeks later, I was like, no, I should stop this. You know, I had to repent from it, you know, and all that stuff. But yeah, there for 2 weeks, I was just, you know, I was okay with the I was the kind of guy who said that. Yeah.
Right. Right.
All right. Let's sum all this up. Maybe let me read for you here a very long quote. And if I do a bad job, maybe I'll just cut it from the As the Story Grows episode. But this is Cliffy Huntington. It's about 55 minutes into the As the Story Grows episode with him, where he talks about this to some extent. He says, we'd done this thing, we had started in, and were kind of a product of this Christian punk rock and Christian music scene, and yet we were not a Christian music band at all. Some of the members are Christians, but the band itself, our lyrics, we were never about proselytizing. God was never the reason for our band. Record labels would always try talking us into recording some songs about God because they could sell more albums if we did that. We were like, no, we're not going to do that, because if we did that, it would make us just like those testaments or something like that in Christian bookstores. We'd be selling the gospel, and we weren't interested in doing that because the gospel is not why we're doing this. We're doing this band because we want to do a band. Sorry, we didn't feel called to use Christian lingo here. We didn't feel called to be in a band. This is not a music ministry. This is guys in a band because it made us feel a certain way and we liked it. That was it. There was nothing we did that was any different than what the Queers did or what Screeching Weasels did or what any of the other bands from that era did. It was the same thing. We just didn't swear because we were good boys. Other than that, our scene, what we wrote about, we just wrote about stuff that stuck up with other people over the years. We realized that by never giving into that thing, to sell more records by being more Christian in that scene, we were ostracized a lot from the Christian scene. And then we were ostracized from the secular scene too. A lot of people from the secular scene just didn't get it. They thought we were just good Christian boys, which none of that could be further from the truth. But we got a bad rep from them, and then a bad rep from the Christian scene because we weren't Christian enough. We were in this middle-of-the-road band. We could have been a lot bigger, but we realized we kind of built ourselves a legacy because we never sold out. And so the respect that people have for us over the years has just grown.
And to follow that, I want to say I found an interview with them from a 1999 issue of HM Magazine, and Cliffy says basically the same thing. There's a lot of money to be made in ministry. We feel like we could make a lot more money, make a whole lot more sales if we decided to make our songs a lot more spiritual than they are, but we don't feel that we're supposed to do that. So this is almost 15, 20 years before that interview,
right,
saying the same thing, which I'll be honest, I have a lot of respect for. Like, I think it's cool that they stuck with that the whole time. And especially, I know early on, I'm sure they were getting a lot of flack for it.
Yeah.
When they were
especially before they were established.
Right. But I think that was the right way to go. And again, I think that's one reason the bands maybe had some longevity, is they were able to kind of sidestep a lot of that drama that went along with that stuff.
I also appreciate comparing it to Testaments, you know, which is just like, which are the stupidest thing ever. It's just like, this is a normal mint, but what we're going to do is we're going to add a little cross into the mold, and then we're going to put verses on the wrapper, and now it's a Christian mint, and we can sell it at the register of Christian bookstores.
You might be able to get someone to accept Jesus in their heart if they have one of these mints.
Sure.
It's an evangelism tool. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, all right. So what'd you think of the artwork, Jay?
Well, considering it's completely copied from a polka group called The Naturals in the 1960s, which if you look this up on Discogs, it's the photo is actually in color. It works for this album. I don't know how they got away with copying this blatantly like this, but maybe the group just isn't around anymore. No one bothered to, you know, mess with it. But it works for it. It's not amazing, but, you know, for their first album, it's all right.
Yeah, even the back is from that album.
Ah, interesting.
Okay. I mean, the picture is replaced with a picture of the actual band, of the actual Huntingtons, but the whole back layout
they just
is
copied
the same.
It too. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. On the back, the picture is of Mikey is playing a jazz master, which he plays bass, but he's playing a jazz master here, a Fender jazz master. Mikey with an E does have, you know, drumsticks and a snare, and then Cliffy has a very expensive Rickenbacker here, so definitely not their guitars. And then I like this, it says this record can be played with either stereophonic or monophonic equipment with no degradation of sound quality. On the inside there actually are some other pictures of the band, and in the thank yous they actually mention Uzziah, which is 121, and a few loose screws, and Burnt Toast News. Have you ever heard of Burnt Toast News?
I think Scott Hatch did some kind of zine of Burnt Toast before he made Burnt Toast Vinyl. I think actually Burnt Toast Vinyl was like a spin-off of that. So I think that's maybe what that is.
Okay. They thank the Crickets for making us change our name. And then a bunch of other stuff. Garlic Press, as you've mentioned before, Flying Tart, Goody Hook. In that interview with As the Story Grows, Cliffy mentions that they kind of got started around the same time as Goody Hook, and they're both on the East Coast, you know, so that's a different group that's then, you know, what's going on with Most Tooth and Nail type stuff. That's the majority of the scene, you know.
What did you think about recording quality of the album?
It's fine. It's not great, you know. I read that it was never mastered, and mastered is just the part where they come back and they make each track the same relative loudness as all the other tracks, so then you don't get blown away from one track to the other. And it's fine. Like, there's nothing in it that jumps out to me, never has been, that jumps out to me as that being missing. But it's good. It's not great for, you know, 96, I think it was fine.
Yeah, it's fine for me too. They re-recorded a lot of these songs for something called Rock and Roll Habits for the New Wave that they put out in 2001. And honestly, yeah. I kind of prefer these old versions. I may be in the minority here, but it's just that's what I heard first. That's what I know.
Yeah.
So I like.
I don't know. Did they re-record them just because they didn't like the recording quality, or did they re-record them to get the rights back? Because Flying Tart was sold. They may have lost the actual recording rights to, like, so have you been paying attention to what Taylor Swift is doing, where she's re-recording all of her early albums?
No.
Right, me either. But it is an interesting legal issue, because she owns the songs, she just doesn't own the recording. So she doesn't own the recordings of her early albums, so she doesn't get paid for them. So she's just re-recording them sound for sound and putting them back out so that she owns the recording and she gets paid for them.
Clever. Okay.
So maybe they owned the songs, but they didn't own the recording, right? So
yeah, I was always under the impression they just didn't like the way it sounded, so they wanted to redo it. But I don't. But you're right. Maybe I don't know.
Okay. I mean, I never had a problem with, you know, like I said, there was the one song that was kind of a little messy, you know, Teenage Queen. There was one song that I thought had some. Which one is it? Oh, Heidi Hates Me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a good song, but it has, I think, the weakest writing on the album, because it's Heidi Hates Me So, Heidi Hates Me So, Heidi Hates Me So, Heidi, Heidi Ho. That Heidi, Heidi Ho part is ridiculous.
Right.
But that's a great song. So I don't really have a problem with any of this.
I honestly will say, too, I'm pretty impressed, because when you listen to their final Cricket release, which was recorded in, like, April of 95.
Right.
And see the growth between that and this, which is recorded less than a year later, it's like, wow. Yeah. Wrote a lot of catchy songs in a short amount of time.
The Cricket release reminds me of, like, songs that I write, and that they're competent songwriting, but they're just kind of boring. So it's interesting the leap that they made forward between that recording and, like you said, and this, yeah. All right, Jay. Well, where are they now?
Oh, boy. I'm hoping you can help me with this, Clifton, because there's a lot. So first of all, they're still a band. They actually released an album. We're in 2022 now, so in 2020. So they're still doing stuff. But to try to catch us up a little bit after this release, a few months after they recorded this, they went back into the studio and recorded a self-released Ramones cover album called Rocket to Ramonia. In 97, so again, not that long after this, they put out their second album called Fun and Games, which is also on Flying Tart. They did record that one with kind of the famous pop-punk producer Mass Giorgini at his Sonic Iguana Studios. It sounds like Cliff basically just, like, found this guy's phone number, called him. He's like, send me an album. He sent it to him. He's like, yeah, I like this. I'll produce it. So, which is awesome. After that, though, Flying Tart was no longer really going to be a label, so they made the jump to Tooth and Nail and released High School Rock in 1998. And in 1999, they released a live album called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Later in that year, went even more Ramones-ish and released both Get Lost, which is, like, Mike kind of, like, starts to sound more like Joey Ramone. Like, it just sounds more like Ramones. And they released File Under Ramones, another Ramones cover album. And then early 2000, they released Plastic Surgery, which is songs that were recorded at the same time they recorded Get Lost. So if you're following, that's four albums in about a year's time. It's a little bit nuts. And one of those, I think it was a different podcast I listened to with Mike, but they talked about basically how they learned, they paid a lot of attention when they recorded, And so they learned kind of how to do it on their own. So they just basically started going into the same studio, Clay Creek Studios, but they knew what they were doing. And so with a little bit of money, they could knock out a ton of songs. So it was like, you know, Tooth and Nail would give them whatever budget. And they said, okay, cool. We'll just use fractions of that and crank out multiple albums because we know what we're doing. In fact, I think they recorded The Good, Bad, and the Ugly live for like $500-$600.
$400.
$400. Okay. And it was their biggest selling record at the time. Yeah. Like the label didn't even want them to do that.
Right. Yeah.
But they were like, yeah, you know, we'll just see what happens. Here it is. You want to put it out? Okay. $400. I mean, what do they have to lose? And it worked out great. But getting back to it, in 2001, they re-recorded a lot of these songs, like I talked about, for an album called Rock and Roll Habits for the New Wave, which Burnt Toast Vinyl released. Also in 2001, they released their final album for Tooth and Nail called Songs in the Key of You. This is also the first album to have Josh Blackway on guitar, who kind of has become a very permanent member of the band. He's been in the band since then. Mm-hmm. They've had a lot of lineup changes, but it's pretty much since that time been Mike, Cliff, although Cliff did leave the band for a little bit in the mid-2000s. He went and formed a band called The Stivs, but then he came back. Mike Pierce, the drummer, is on a lot of the albums, but didn't tour with the band because he had commitments, so they got a lot of like touring drummers. And then Josh Blackway is in it too. Since then, now, catching up to the present, and I'm skipping a lot, but it just... Basically, the Huntingtons released a self-titled album in the mid-2000s. They've got a bunch of splits. They put together some other kind of compilation albums. But their next real album is not until 2020, which is... And what is the name of that one, Clifton? Muerto... what's it called?
I'm not going to try to pronounce it.
I'm going to try and butcher it. It's Muerto Carcel o Rock and Roll. I think it means like death, prison, or rock and roll. And that came out in 2020 with a new drummer who's kind of become part of the band named Chris. And I think that's kind of their steady lineup now. They've gone through a lot of drummers. They've had a lot of second guitarists bounce in and out of the band. But
they lost two guitarists to Squad 5-0.
Right. But they're still going. They're actually playing in March in Chicago with Flatfoot 56. I'm hoping they're going to play some other times this year because I'd love to try to go see them. Yeah, they're still doing stuff. So, good news.
Yeah, and that new album's great.
Exactly. Yeah, you really should give it a listen. They haven't really lost anything. It's very good.
All right, Jay, we've had some requests for albums to do next, but I can't find any of those messages right now, so I guess we'll try that again next time. So what are we going to do for our next episode?
We are listening to Plank Eye's The Spark.
Awesome. Yeah, so Plank Eye was one of my favorite bands in high school, and this is the first listenable album, I think, by them. Spill's a good album, but it's just...
They
need to turn the bass down a little bit.
You can skip Spill and move to this album. Yeah. I think most people would agree. It's fine to start with Spark.
It's more punk rock, but it's not. It's yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. The Spark by Plank Eye next time. Sounds great.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Your Music Saved Us.
If you enjoyed your time with us, please leave a review or share this episode. Visit our website, yourmusicsavedus.com, to find all the ways to listen. We're on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Join our Facebook group or follow us to keep up with the latest or interact with us. Send compliments and disagreements to yourmusicsavedus@gmail.com. We do check that every once in a while.
The music in this episode is the work of the Huntingtons and is used with apologies, not permission.
Yeah. And all of their stuff is on Bandcamp. Of course, you can stream it on Spotify and probably other places, but all of it's on Bandcamp if you want to throw some dollars their way. We encourage that. It's good. And there's some live shows on there, too. And, of course, all the Foundation albums go over there.
And they have merch. They just put out a new t-shirt that actually says Heavy Metal's Live in Baltimore. I think I'm going to order one. So there's some cool stuff on there.
And you know what's really depressing is that heavy metal is still alive and well, and it's really, like, mind-numbingly around. It's just everywhere.
Oh, man. I guess you don't want to cover, like, a Baron Cross album, or you're not going to be a Striper on this show. Okay.
Yeah. All right. I feel like heavy metal's become, like, the dad rock. Where dad rock used to be, like, 60s garage rock, heavy metal's, like, the new dad rock.
Well, I mean,
like, everyone is just playing it. Yeah. All right. Bye.
See ya. Hey, I'm gonna honestly, like, look at this Jawbreaker stuff more. If they put out more dates, I'll definitely
Bro.
Part of me was like, oh shit, I should just fly out to one of these, but that's a little bit... I really would like to see him with Jawbox. That would be bad ass, but...
Yes.
I don't know. The Chicago one is the one that would be the most likely that I could pull off, because we have direct flights from here to Chicago, so it's a little easier, but...
We have direct flights from here to Chicago, too.
Mm-hmm. Denver lives in Denver, so maybe, but that's still...
Oh, cool.
I don't know. I have no interest in going to New York, so...
No. Not right now.
But I'll keep looking. I'll keep checking. We'll see.
All right. I went on a wild ride preparing for this episode.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm
I ended up listening to an early punk band yesterday, an anarcho-punk band from a called Crass. Have you ever listened to them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I know of them, like in England, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're formed out of a commune, an anarchist commune in England, in London. And their first album had a song on it, or it's kind of a spoken word poetry type thing, that was so blasphemous that the band was investigated by Scotland Yard.
I'm going to add another twist. Did you know they were friends with Chumbawamba? You remember that band? I get knocked
really
down.
Interesting.
And Chumbawamba is actually an anarchist group. And they're really fascinating.
I know.
because their politics are not at all what you think. And they even one time on TV, one of the women in the band, it was some big interview in America, like basically told people to steal their album. It was just like, yeah, we don't care. Steal it from the bookstores. They're like, we already got paid. And so, yeah, they're pretty fun too. Anyway, I have a newfound appreciation for them.
Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah. I also spent a lot of time listening to Screeching Weasels and the Mr. T Experience.
I mean, I've told you, I've been loving that band Teenage Bottle Rocket. Like, this kind of music's just so fun. I feel like if I was in a band, I would play music like this. Like, it's just, like, it's simple, it's easy, it's fun, it's, you know, kind of timeless.
It's not easy to write, though, because it's you have to really work hard to make the same three chords sound different over and over again.
You're right, yeah. And just those catchy melodies, it's not easy.
Yeah, that's really hard. I mean, like, we'll get into this. No, never mind. I'm going to say this later because it's, I want it to be fresh when I say it. Okay.
All right. We're going to try not to do
we should start.
3-hour long podcast. Yeah. Okay.
I know. It could be.
All right.
Okay. Let's go.
Go for it. So I wanted to talk about this song. God damn it. All right. You know what? Whatever.
Just do it.